The plan, several years in preparation, took a few months longer before the Hutu's leaders found the propitious moment to implement it. During its preparation's final phase, the Interahamwe rank and file received a crash course in weaponry so they could aid the mass killing. According to Jacques, who says he killed about 10, "We were taught by corporals from the gendarmes. They gave us 3 days of training. They only taught us how to use grenades and guns. Rifle training started in the city, but for the grenades it was elsewhere. 2 days after the president died, thousands were trained at once. 3 days after the president was killed, the military began to organize the Interahamwe so that they could maintain the roadblocks, and youths from each neighborhood went to get training to fight." Eliminationist ideals and intent are almost never forged in the heat of battle. They are usually long in existence as desires, with their progenitors and bearers waiting for the right time to turn them into concrete, operational plans, and then still later for the right opportunity to implement them. In February 1994, on the eve of the mass murderous assault, when the time seemed ripe and opportunity seemed around the corner, talk of slaughtering the Tutsi was already common in Kigali. A magazine published an article with the headline, "By the way, the Tutsi race could be extinguished." The previous month, the prominent Hutu newspaper Kangura, Wake Others Up, wrote revealingly and prophetically, "Who will survive the March war? The masses will rise with the help of the army, and the blood will flow freely." Political leaders, even tyrants, can sometimes have inhibitions against the radical measures of eliminationist assaults. But nothing more effectively disinhibits leaders and followers alike than a rationale for not having inhibitions in the first place, which eliminationist beliefs of many kinds supply. Less frequent, though in many instances critically important, has been the sight of one's enemy slaughtering or expelling members of one's own people or of other people's, who is therefore said to have proven himself by his own hand to be a threatening barbarian who deserves no mercy. The German occupation forces in the Soviet Union found dead, non-German political prisoners the retreating Soviets had killed and left behind. This further reinforced their demonological views about a construct of their own fantasies, Jewish Bolshevism, and their desire to eradicate the Jews, to whom they falsely imputed the murders. That many of the executed prisoners were Jewish mattered not at all to the Germans. One real or manufactured act of brutality by a member of a hated group can be enough to become a powerful symbol of malevolence and threat that becomes a battle cry or ideological sustenance for an eliminationist purge. For the British settlers in Kenya, this process of turning a few instances of violence into powerful symbols undergirding an eliminationist ideology against the Mau Mau and more broadly against the Kikuyu people has been well documented. During Mau Mau leader Johnstone Jomo Kenyatta's trial, which began in December 1952, the British settlers in Kenya were up in arms, with many calling for the extermination of the Kikuyu. At a protest rally of more than 1,500 settlers, out of a total settler population of only 50,000, in January 1953 in Nairobi, calling for the elimination of the Mau Mau and the summary conviction of Kenyatta and his five co-defendants, one British settler addressed Kenyan Legislative Council member Michael Blundell, who was trying to quell the crowd. "Michael, you'll never cure this problem, you'll never cure it. You put the troops into the Kikuyu villages and you shoot 50,000 of them, men, women, and children." Tales, real or invented, of people killing or brutalizing members of another group, when the thinking about that people is already grounded in deep prejudice and hatred, has provided the impetus in many countries and circumstances for those ready to join an eliminationist assault to give themselves to their leaders' initiatives to expel or slaughter the enemy people. This happened in the most concentrated fashion in Rwanda, where the assassination of Hutu President Juvenal Habyarimana, likely perpetrated by Hutu members of his own movement, was the spectacular event blamed on the Tutsi and the pretext for the exterminationist leadership of the governing National Republican Movement for Democracy to put into action plans long germinating for the final solution to their Tutsi problem. Pancras Hakizamungili, a Hutu mass murderer, explains the entire dynamic. The radios were yammering at us since 1992 to kill all the Tutsi. There was anger after the president's death and a fear of falling under the rule of the Inkotanyi, cockroaches. The Hutu always suspects that some plans are cooking deep in the Tutsi character, nourished in secret since the passing of the Ancien Régime. He sees a threat lurking in even the feeblest or kindest Tutsi. But it is suspicion, not hatred. The hatred came over us suddenly after our president's plane crashed. The intimidators shouted, "Just look at these cockroaches! We told you so!" And we yelled, "Right, let's go hunting!" We weren't that angry. More than anything else, we were relieved. As in Rwanda, hearing reports of the enemy's real or alleged atrocities can render this enemy, and the people in whose name they apparently act, dangerous in a qualitatively different way from ordinary enemies. In Rwanda and elsewhere, Hutu were continuously warned it was an integral part of the Hutu's cultural discourse even before Habyarimana's assassination that the struggle with the Tutsi was one of kill or be killed. Such alleged or real individual acts of violence by the hated group, often accompanied by readily believed accusations that such violence is a harbinger of a generalized assault, creates the rationale for treating this enemy, including non-combatants, with lethal finality. Such an enemy's own putative conduct further easily engenders the thought that such people have already placed themselves outside any law and forfeited all rights and protections, and that by killing them as payback, one is only giving them what they deserve, a kind of rough justice. These cognitive and emotional mechanisms operated powerfully in the aftermath of World War II in Central and Eastern Europe, as the peoples of many of those countries drove millions of ethnic Germans from their homes and killed many tens of thousands during the course of their self-understood revenge. Four kinds of eliminationist assaults. The critical nature of such beliefs and the fact, it is a fact, that structural conditions and opportunity alone do not in themselves produce mass murders and eliminations can be seen by examining eliminationist onslaughts along two fundamental dimensions. Almost all mass murder and eliminationist politics are rooted in conflict over the scarce resources of territory and power, often grounded in the uncertainties of and group demands made during economic and political transformations. Who will control territory and who will have the power to define society's nature and rhythms prominently play into how people conceive of the other's putative threat, and what, including economic advantage, is actually fought over. Yet because controlling territory is itself a form of power, a critical distinction exists between those instances where power alone is sought to dominate and create a society of the perpetrator's image, and where territory is also at stake. The other relevant dimension for mapping eliminationist onslaughts is whether the eliminationist politics are practiced domestically or outside the perpetrator's country. All instances of eliminationist politics can be arrayed along these two dimensions of whether territory is contested and, when it is, whether it is contested within a country's borders or abroad. Category 3 eliminationist assaults, imperialism at home, consists mainly of a state often representing society's dominant group attacking a group or groups to take or secure their territory. The targeted group usually predominates in a particular area and is a perceived threat to secede or to overthrow the state and or the groups it represents. The Turks' slaughter of the Armenians, the Igbos' slaughter of the Hausa, the slaughters during Yugoslavia's breakup, the Russian slaughter of Chechens, and the Sudanese political Islamists' slaughter of Darfurians today are such eliminationist assaults. Category 1 assaults are primarily aimed at domestic domination and transformation, not territory. They seek more to purify a country of a perceived ideological threat, or to transform its polity and society to accord with the state's and often the dominant group's vision. Typically, this includes the desire to secure the dominant or insurgent group's position and power. Such mass murdering and elimination include most communist slaughters, the lethal campaigns against leftists in Latin America, Saddam's mass murdering, and the reciprocal killings in Rwanda and Burundi of Hutu and Tutsi. The strange case is Al-Qaeda. Because Osama bin Laden and other Al-Qaeda leaders perceived the United States as the principal impediment to their totalitarian aims of dominating and transforming Islamic countries into political Islamic theocracies, they struck abroad in the American homeland. But their aspirations were always overwhelmingly domestic. Category 4 assaults, imperialism abroad, consist of a state and its people seeking to subdue a foreign territory to colonize or exploit it. Usually, the national group killing, expelling, incarcerating, or brutally subjugating the foreign territory's people is a minority, often a tiny minority compared to the victim group. This was so of the Belgians in Congo, the Japanese in Asia, the Germans in Poland, Ukraine, and Russia, the British in Kenya, the Indonesians in East Timor, and the Chinese in Tibet. Category 2 assaults, madness abroad, are the least numerous. They are slaughters abroad having nothing to do with territorial domination or with domestic conflicts that have a foreign component. The only such eliminationist assaults, all of them mass murders, are the Germans' extermination of the Jews, Sinti, and Roma. Mapping eliminationist onslaughts along these two dimensions helps clarify several differing features. If we were to compare this breakdown to one for the 18th and 19th centuries, the earlier eliminationist assaults would be weighted to Category 4, imperialism abroad, when the European colonizing powers sought to gain or secure territories on other continents. By the second half of the 20th century, the age of imperialism was winding down, making for fewer contested territories abroad. This makes apparent a fundamental fact that is crucial for crafting institutions and policies to reduce eliminationist politics incidence. Almost all such politics in the recent past and today are domestic rather than international. Authors note, this is that much truer if we, as I do, conceive of the eliminationist politics that follow the breakup of empires and of countries or attempted secessions as domestic. In the former Soviet Union and the former Yugoslavia, different governments and ethnic groups fought over whether territories would remain a part of the countries or emerge as independent successor states. Essentially, secessionist movements contested territories formerly dominated by central governments and the ethnic groups they represented. At least for the foreseeable future, the world is unlikely to see large-scale imperialist conquest. It is more likely to continue to suffer murderous domestic power struggles for group domination or a country's integrity being contested from within. This matrix also highlights the realistic nature of the conflicts that are the contexts for eliminationist politics and mass murder. When people kill or expel others, power, control, or territory is almost always acutely at issue, even though their hatred or demonology wildly exceeds the real or perceived threat, and murderous reaction is evil and irrational. Understanding most such assaults' realistic basis further explains not only why the eliminationist politics of Category 4, imperialism abroad, has mainly disappeared, but also why we are unlikely to see many such foreign imperialist and eliminationist forays as long as the international state system and international institutions maintain something resembling their current configurations. These issues are discussed further in Chapter 11. The realistic basis of eliminationist politics also highlights the oddness that Category 2, madness abroad, is not empty. It is understandable that one country's people might try to kill or eliminate the people of the territory or country they conquer and wish to control, exploit for resources, or colonize. But why the Germans would undertake a global assault on the Jews, seeking to annihilate a people abroad posing no threat to them, having no enmity for them, controlling no territory or critical resources that they wanted, is simply not, by any rational standard, comprehensible. Only a rare and powerful ideological pathology could produce such bizarre politics, with a manifestly self-injurious cost-benefit calculus historically at odds with other mass eliminations. If the Germans had not slaughtered the Jews, most people, I expect, would have said that the mass murder of an utterly figmental enemy outside one's country would never take place, and Category 2 should be empty. It was madness abroad. That it has happened highlights the almost singular place of Jews and Sinti and Roma as victims in eliminationism's annals. But this type of annihilationist assault is now more possible. As never before, technology empowers the weak to strike anywhere, making it thinkable for quasi-hallucinatory regimes and groups to lash out abroad genocidally, as Al-Qaeda did at the United States and its people. With an unrivaled global power guaranteeing the world's basic international political and economic order, suicidal attacks upon the United States can seem to make sense to the ideologized mind. Interestingly, the perpetrators of Madness Abroad's two principal mass murders conceived of the assaults as defensive and liberationist against two targets, the Jews and the United States, deemed to be global powers and principally responsible for the world's evil. This was totally fictional regarding Jews, making the madness complete. This was not fictional, at least about the United States' power, its actual and immensely powerful antagonism against political Islam, making the attack grounded in reality and a militarily self-defeating, suicidal act of madness. For general explanatory purposes, such exceptional and strange cases are far less important than the norm. Realistic conflict over power, territory, or the desire to create a new political and social order. Such real conflicts are, or could be, almost everywhere. The danger of the most catastrophic forms of eliminationist politics is enormously widespread. Non-eliminationist outcomes. Political leaders and followers have frequently practiced eliminationist politics. Yet compared to the enormously greater incidence of conflict over power and territory and the desire to craft a new political and social order, such politics has been relatively infrequent. Why then do such conflicts and transformative desires sometimes produce eliminationist politics, but mostly not? The answer cannot be the conflict's kind or structural conditions alone, including stressors or economic and political development, because many societies with such conflicts and structural relationships have not erupted in mass murder or elimination. The following matrix illustrates similar kinds of conflicts and structural relationships that have not produced eliminationist outcomes. Internally located contests not concerned with territory are called domestic dominations and transformations. Examples of this form of non-eliminationist assaults include the contestation between Nazis and German communists, the United States and Nazis, Cambodia and Khmer Rouge, former communist countries and former communists, black-dominated South Africa and whites, as well as Egypt and political Islamists. Externally located contests not concerned with territory are called Madness Abroad. An example of such a contest would be the U.S. slaughtering Buddhist monks around the world. Internally located contests that are concerned with territory are labeled Imperialism at Home. Examples include Britain and Northern Irish Catholics, Czechs and Slovaks, Gorbachev's Soviet Union with Ukraine, and former Yugoslavia and Slovenes. Lastly, externally located contests that are concerned with territory are called Imperialism Abroad. This form of non-eliminationist assault includes Germany's occupation of France, uprisings in Soviet-controlled Hungary, Poland, and East Germany, and the U.S. occupation of Iraq. This matrix's cases had similar causal factors of conflict, territory, context, etc., but those political leaders and regimes did not murder or eliminate their enemies. Why? Among the various reasons, two have been critical: their different non-eliminationist conceptions of the potential victims, and their adherence to a non-eliminationist social and moral theory about right action. The idea that the potential targets are beings of a type that deserve to be eliminated is not one that animates the potential perpetrators. In those instances where such eliminationist notions might have existed, the regimes have been led by people embedded in unpropitious politics, including democratic politics, or simply unwilling to act politically in such a manner. Even if they have been, then they would have had to contend with societies unlikely to follow them. South Africa is a critical and revealing example. The conditions for a murderous onslaught by whites against blacks and then blacks against whites were there. The conventional wisdom about what produces genocides, focusing on structural conditions, conflict-ridden societies, enormous suffering, enormous hatred, or a previously suppressed and newly empowered majority's thirst for revenge, suggests a bloodbath, or perhaps two reciprocal bloodbaths. At the time, this was a widely articulated conventional wisdom about blacks coming to power. Whites did use political and legal measures and violence to control and exploit blacks in an elaborate and brutal system of segregation and disabilities called apartheid, which itself was a complex form of eliminationist politics. However, the whites never expelled or slaughtered large numbers of blacks and never, as far as we know, considered it. Had the apartheid leaders not feared the highly attentive West's reactions, they likely would have eliminated the anti-apartheid black political leadership. The more predicted mass murderous and eliminationist violence was expected to come from blacks against whites, led by the insurgent African National Congress, which for decades had been resisting and fighting the whites' apartheid regime. The extreme oppression, exploitation, and violence blacks had suffered had lasted generations. Blacks lived in impoverished, barren reservations known as Bantustans, while whites lived in relative luxury, even at European levels. Hatred of the whites, particularly of Afrikaners, for keeping blacks poor, denying them basic rights and freedoms, and using violence against them was widespread. Why then, after decades of this unjust and dehumanizing system, was there no substantial revenge, no eliminationist onslaught? Many factors came into play, including the drawn-out negotiation process that created an understanding among white and black leaders. The peaceful transfer of power with interim confidence-building arrangements. The lessons African National Congress leaders undoubtedly drew from other African countries, such as Mozambique, where white minorities fled or were hounded out after black majorities wrested power from them, wrecking the national economy. But still, why did the structural conditions of a bitter conflict lasting years and soaked in blood and suffering, with deep racial, linguistic, economic, and political fissures, resulting in the once subjugated, desperately needy majority, turning the tables on a relatively small, dominant minority, not lead to a slaughter or expulsion or some other form of violent domination and expropriation? The answer is as obvious as theories of structural causes are wrong. Political leadership, and specifically, the character, disposition, and foresight of the African National Congress's most critical leader, Nelson Mandela, who had no desire to undertake an eliminationist program. Had black South Africans had a non-Mandelan leadership animated by an ideology of revenge, black nationalism, Marxist revolution, or self-enrichment, then it would have been easy to unleash the African National Congress and its followers in a violent eliminationist and expropriationist campaign against whites. With different political leaders operating under similar circumstances against a similar foe, the spark would have come to ignite hatred and retribution's parched dry timber. A violent catastrophe would have ensued. Why could Mandela and the other African National Congress leaders see their way to a peaceful new South Africa? They knew the whites were neither demons nor subhumans. The transition process helped further humanize white leaders. They came to understand that the future would be better with whites as part of the nation, governed by democracy, rather than forced out or dispossessed to varying degrees. And no ideological vision of some purified, totalitarian, or millennial South African society guided them. The black leadership therefore created the humanizing truth and reconciliation process, where perpetrators, through public admissions of sins and crimes, remade themselves and re-entered the ranks of beings fit for human cohabitation. The course of South African politics utterly falsifies structural theories of mass murder. It highlights political leaders' critical part in deciding whether an eliminationist course will be chosen, and if so, what kind. Finally, and perhaps most important, it offers lessons, including about political leaders' capacity to learn that eliminationist politics may not pay and to choose to act accordingly against such politics, that are critical for designing policy measures to forestall future eliminationist politics. Ultimately, each case contained in the matrix of non-eliminationist outcomes must be investigated individually and in depth. Nevertheless, the fundamental factors that did not lead these contexts to erupt in murderous and eliminationist assaults were the political leaders' differing conceptions of the victims and/or their adherence to a political vision that rendered elimination unthinkable or, in balance, not advisable. The crucial character of perpetrators' beliefs. These two matrices help us understand the critical role of the perpetrators' beliefs about hatred and disparaged groups in generating their desire and willingness to kill those groups and then to act upon the desire. Why? Because they reveal the perpetrators' beliefs about the targeted people to be the factor that engenders the motive and the motivation to kill or eliminate the targeted groups. Even with existing conflict, slaughtering or expelling hated or enemy groups is always a choice. Neither poverty, nor war, nor multi-ethnic societies, nor acute ethnic conflict invariably or even usually produce mass murder or elimination. They also do not determine what kind and how much there will be. That the politics that produces mass death and elimination is discretionary can be seen in another related, indeed overlapping realm, that of famines. Famines are not only or even principally caused by acts of nature. This has been long established, though it is little known. In our time, the modern state's greatly expanded monitoring powers, it knows where food is needed, resource acquisition capacity, it can acquire food, and infrastructure, it can deliver the food, have long overcome non-human causes of famines. Whether state leaders decide not to alleviate famine situations, or through their own policies to actually cause them, or armed killers physically prevent states and non-state actors from providing food to famine regions and peoples, the cause and result are the same. Willful political choices that predictably result in mass death, sometimes millions, with the means of death being willful starvation. That famine is a matter of politics and political leaders' choices has been generally shown, though it can be most strikingly seen in the Indian subcontinent's history alone, and then by comparing it with other regions. The subcontinent is a large, historically famine-plagued region containing developing countries of colossal populations. Until Indian independence in 1947, the British colonialists ignored vulnerable and even starving Indians' well-being, so famines were common. Once the country was independent and democratic, Indian political authorities responded to regional and local shortages by bringing food into those regions, sometimes with international aid, and by giving the most destitute the economic means to acquire food for themselves. India ceased to be visited by starvation. This, in itself, is telling. Comparing India to China further highlights the critical role of politics and of human choice. China, facing similar problems of overpopulation, underdevelopment, and local food shortages, continued to suffer famines, including massive ones. The Great Famine, undoubtedly human history's most deadly famine, occurred in 1959, lasting 2 years while taking 20 million to 40 million lives. It resulted from willful governmental policies. In the 1970s, two regions suffered from severe drought and a food crisis: India's Maharashtra state and Africa's Sahel region, which includes Ethiopia, Somalia, and Sudan. Maharashtra's crisis from 1972 to 1974 included a precipitous drop in average per capita food consumption, yet the Indian government intervened and famine was averted. The Sahel drought during the 1970s produced a severe famine that devastated the lives of millions, killing perhaps 1 million. But their deaths did not result from a natural catastrophe greater than that of Maharashtra. The Sahel countries actually had considerably more food available per capita, 2 to 3 times as much during their famines than Maharashtra had during the dry years, and the Sahel's per capita food availability was roughly equal to that of India as a whole. In the Sahel, political leaders chose not to distribute food to the needy. Finally, in 1974 in Bangladesh, India's neighbor, perhaps 1 million people died in a famine. Yet in that year, more food was available in Bangladesh than in previous or subsequent years when there was no famine. The people producing or not alleviating famines have various motives. Some famines are a tool in regimes' mass eliminationist repertoire. Others are the consequence of political leaders' malign neglect. China's Great Famine resulted from Mao's murderous policies that willfully sacrificed millions in pursuit of his communist goals. The Sahel Famine's roots were not classically grounded in mass murder and elimination politics. But even with economic causes of people's vulnerability to famine, insufficient work or wages, governments and political leaders decide whether to right the situation in the immediate term, principally by choosing whether to provide food or income transfers to the endangered people. Regimes willfully withholding food from people has been one of the recurring features of our time's eliminationist and annihilationist assaults, often employed as an adjunct to other eliminationist measures. This makes analyzing famine politics and its place in eliminationist politics somewhat more complex, but only when it is hard to decide whether a given instance of general or local food shortages is due to malign neglect, purposeful action, or both. We have already come across any number of instances of purposeful starvation to kill targeted peoples. The Germans fed the Jews in ghettos and camps starvation rations, leading to enormous death rates. The Germans willfully starved most of the millions of Soviet POWs they killed. On death marches, regimes and their followers routinely deny adequate food to their victims. Or as the Germans did to the Herero and the Turks did to the Armenians, drive them into inhospitable places so they will starve to death. The British, in their multi-pronged eliminationist program to neutralize the Kikuyu's threat, underfed them, pruning their numbers and pressuring them to capitulate and renounce Mau Mau. Despite the many other horrors the British visited on the Kikuyu, discussed at greater length shortly, what many Kikuyu remember most about the eliminationist assault is the hunger. It was so bad and so obviously manufactured that many Kikuyu concluded that the British sought to starve them to death or into submission. As Wandia Muri-Ithi explains, "Hunger was the worst problem. That's what was killing most of the people. They were starving us on purpose, hoping we would give in. The little time we were allowed to go to the Shamba was too short to allow for any meaningful food gathering. Also, the area we were allowed to use was too small, because the largest areas had been declared special areas and were off limits. So the allowed areas had been over-harvested, but that was what we had." The barbed wire village's death tolls were enormous, with the most vulnerable falling prey to disease, as the vulnerable always do when starving. One missionary recounts that it was terribly pitiful how many of the children and the older Kikuyu were dying. They were so emaciated and so very susceptible to any kind of disease that came along. Most of the 100,000 to 300,000 Kikuyu dead resulted from British starvation politics. Mass elimination is always preventable and always results from conscious political choice. Therefore, the perpetrators or potential perpetrators' conception of potential target groups is the critical factor for leaders and followers alike to want to practice mass eliminationist and exterminationist politics and then to be willing to carry out its programs. This suggests several further inquiries. We must investigate more how such eliminationist conceptions about different groups are disseminated, which means also investigating the discourses that are structured by, contain, and spread such notions. We must consider how language is mass murder and elimination's medium, and we must make sense of how such discourses and beliefs vary to produce various kinds of assaults. When the peculiarly modern mass eliminationist leadership's mindset finds propitious political circumstances for acting, it draws on, makes central, and sometimes helps solidify and amplify pre-existing beliefs or a discourse about elimination, inflaming people's smoldering wishes into burning desires. Discourses deprecating and disparaging targeted groups, leading people to hate and feel threatened by them, prepare the way before a mass elimination program is initiated. These discourses vary greatly. Some are more obviously eliminationist, even explicitly murderous, than others. Sometimes, as in Turkey regarding Armenians, Germany regarding Jews, Rwanda regarding Tutsi, and Serbia regarding Croats and Muslims, the discourse is long-standing, its underlying beliefs about the intended victims, which it reinforces and further spreads, are themselves deeply rooted in the cultures and widely, though not universally, shared. Other discourses are chronologically proximate to the elimination program's onset, while still resonating within the populace and being deeply felt by those sharing its fundamentals. This has often been the case under communist regimes, most notably the Soviets, the Chinese, and the Khmer Rouge. These and other communist leaderships, with newly won power, sought to prepare their followers and society more broadly for eliminationist initiatives by convincing them that producing the future utopia necessitated the sacrifice of many people, specifically malignant class enemies and other groups deemed inimical to the revolution, the nation, or the future communist paradise. Such new discourses existed in Germany during the Nazi period regarding life unworthy of living and useless eaters, in many Latin American countries regarding leftists, and in the United States regarding Japanese. Because these discourses are less long-standing and are sometimes manufactured mainly from above, sometimes clashing with common, deeply held values and beliefs, They often find less societal consensus and are more easily dispensed with when the regime or their proximate cause ends. Anti-Semitism, an age-old and deep-rooted discourse, continued to be powerful in Germany and many European countries after the war, and continues to this day, while the far less deep-rooted and widespread notion that life unworthy of living and useless eaters, including the mentally ill, should be killed, itself died with the Nazi regime. The preparatory Turkish discourse for slaughtering Armenians in 1915 was unmistakable, containing three facets: the need for a Turkic Turkey, an Islamic Turkey, and an internally pure Turkey so it could reestablish its greatness and glory. Under Turkish Ottoman rule, Turks conceived of the Armenians as an alien group to be tolerated as long as they remained loyal. With the Ottomans' decline in the latter part of the 19th century and loss of territories to other countries and non-Turkish minorities in the 20th century's first part, Turks somewhat redefined the ever more nationalist Armenians through the lens of an ever more strident Turkish nationalism as an alien, hostile, and threatening group. Annihilationist onslaughts from 1894 to 1896 that were essentially a massive crackdown on Armenian demands for more independence, and again after the Young Turk Revolution in April 1909, helped form, shape, and intensify the discourse of disloyalty and the need for a purer, more Turkified Turkey. If your countrymen have already justly slaughtered people because of their ethnicity or forced them to convert from a religion deemed noxious and alien, further eliminating this people, including by deadly means, will likely seem justified. Those killed deserved it, being of a character or having committed offenses that made eliminating them necessary and right. Such self-legitimizing, tautological reasoning is powerful. Mass elimination, including the mass murder of children, remains, after the fact, self-justifying to the perpetrating group, unless it is explicitly and forcefully delegitimized, as in post-World War II Germany. Mass expulsions and slaughters sow the seeds for future eliminationist assaults. The logic that led to one eliminationist assault provides the rationale for new and future ones, if circumstances and political leaders suggest it. The Turks' massive eliminationist assault upon the Armenians from 1894 to 1896 would rightly be called the Armenian Genocide, had an even more massive mass murder and elimination not followed 20 years later. From 1894 to 1896, the Turks slaughtered 150,000 to 300,000 Armenians, forced another 150,000 to convert to Islam, and expelled an additional 100,000 from the country. The Turks, as perpetrators, repeatedly have employed different eliminationist means as functional equivalents. They also availed themselves of a relatively rare eliminationist option as an acceptable partial solution to their Armenian problem. The character of their religiously infused demonology about the Armenians meant they could convert Armenians to Islam and thereby render them harmless and fit for cohabitation with Turks. By 1915, Turkey was animated by a nationalism much more oriented toward creating a Turkic nation, so the Turks, opting for a still more comprehensive eliminationist assault against the Armenians, began using a more final mix of means to produce an enormously higher ratio of death and expulsion, close to 2 million to forced conversions of 100,000 to 200,000 women and young children. The German vice consul in Erzurum, Max Erwin von Schubner-Richter, based on his conversations with Turkish officials, reported their thinking in 1916. The empire must be rebuilt on a Muslim and pan-Turkist foundation. Non-Muslim communities have to be Islamicized by force, or failing that, eliminated. This more comprehensive murderousness partly resulted from a consciousness that eliminating Armenians must be more final because the Turks' very actions would guarantee the Armenians' enduring enmity. As Tallet told American Ambassador Henry Morgenthau, "We have been reproached for making no distinction between the innocent Armenians and the guilty. But that was utterly impossible in view of the fact that those who were innocent today might be guilty tomorrow." Eliminationist assault's logic, engendering enmity that might lead to revenge, produces among the perpetrators ever more insecurity and therefore ever more thought to continue or escalate such politics. What a man close to Pol Pot conveyed about the Cambodian mass murderer could be said, if somewhat less breathlessly, about many eliminationist leaders. Pol Pot saw enemies as rotting flesh, as swollen flesh, enemies surrounding, enemies in front, enemies behind, enemies to the north, enemies to the south, enemies to the west, enemies to the east, enemies in all 8 directions, enemies coming from all 9 directions, closing in, leaving no space for breath. And he continually had us fortify our spirit, fortify our stance, fortify over and over, including measures to kill our own ranks. In Rwanda, a different, more explicitly demonizing and eliminationist discourse governed the country starting before the country's independence from Belgium in 1962. The same can be said about Burundi, its intimate neighbor and sometimes mirror opposite. Each one's eliminationist politics is hard to understand without referring to the others. In each country with one group dominating the other, reciprocal racist ideologies of Hutu and Tutsi demonizing each other in terms reminiscent of the Nazis' demonization of the Jews created ideational powder kegs that political leaders could explode at any moment. Each country's coups, attempted coups, repressions, and violence of one group against the other, including mass slaughters and expulsions, greatly affected the other country's political ideologies and politics. Published tracts codified each one's eliminationist ideology. In 1990 in Rwanda, the politically dominant Hutu published in the authoritative newspaper Kangura the religiously clothed 10 Commandments of the Hutu. In Burundi, the dominant Tutsi published their analog, 17 Rules of Tutsi Conduct. The Hutu's 10 Commandments presumes and calls for an insuperable social, political, moral, and racial gulf between Hutu and Tutsi, with several of its commandments warning Hutu men of Tutsi women's purely subversive nature, deeming any Hutu man marrying or having sexual or business relations with a Tutsi woman a traitor. They deem every Tutsi in business dishonest, declaring that the Tutsi's only aim is to enhance the supremacy of his ethnic group. Any Hutu engaging in business with Tutsi is a traitor. Based on this conception of the Tutsi, the Hutu Ten Commandments logically calls for total Hutu political, educational, and military domination. The Hutu's discourse about Tutsi depicted them as racially unalterable, demonic foes who had been suppressing and injuring the Hutu for hundreds of years. The Tutsi's reciprocal discourse was at least as racist, dehumanizing, and demonizing. In 1993, the 17 Rules of Tutsi Conduct codified in published form the long-established eliminationist stance toward the Hutu that had already erupted in several mass slaughters. Do not trust a Hutu or anyone supposed to be one. Try to locate Hutu residences so that you will know, when the time comes, whom to save and whom to liquidate. Stay armed so as not to be caught by surprise. Some Hutu women look like Tutsi, and their job is to spy on us. There are subtle ways to exterminate Hutu people. You can isolate them in the bush and make them disappear one after the other. You can send them pretty girls or Rwandese prostitutes. You can put TB in their food or drinks. Hutu kids are spoiled and insouciant. Just get hold of the kid who lost his way, then ask his father, elder, brother, or mother to come and fetch him, and then kill them all. The Hutus and Tutsis' dueling eliminationist discourses partly parallel, while being more explicitly and graphically murderous, the German eliminationist anti-Semitism about the Jews and the Jewish problem. What is remarkable about the Hutus and Tutsis eliminationist conflict is that it was reciprocal and historically a relatively recent construction, unlike the Germans' one-sided eliminationist anti-Semitism that had roots and a continuous existence lasting centuries. Cynical Belgian colonialists bred the Hutus and Tutsis' enmity to more easily and effectively rule their colonial possession. Once the Hutu and Tutsis' divide hardened, producing parallel demonizing discourses, both sides' political and religious leaders and ideologues intensified and further racialized it. This shows that while the origins of an eliminationist discourse and its generational transmission must be explored to fully understand an eliminationist assault's genesis, the discourse's prior longevity is not a critical factor. Its existence at the moment political leaders decide to kill is what counts. Although a Nazi-like discourse about another people as evil cannot be created anywhere, the Tutsis and Hutus conflict also shows that under propitious circumstances, such as existed in Central Africa, a divided society with deep inequality and acute conflict over resources, one group's domination of the other, originally Tutsi of Hutu, and determinedly malevolent politicians and propagandists, such views can be produced in a generation, hardened, passed on, and then reinforced as the ensuing violence seems to confirm the eliminationist discourse's underpinnings and claims. Among our time's many eliminationist assaults, whether against small or large groups, whether over territory or not, whether at home or abroad, only the German slaughter of the Jews needed to be total, because the Germans considered them cosmic biological evil. The ground for mass murder was prepared in other European countries, in Croatia, France, Lithuania, Poland, Romania, Ukraine, and others, by the widespread, if varying, pan-European Christian anti-Semitism, especially of the Catholic Church, nationalist and sometimes racist demonological assaults on the Jews, and non-lethal eliminationist policies of the 1930s. The Germans' drive to kill all Jews, especially all Jewish children, has no parallel in mass murder or eliminationist politics annals. Many mass murderers slaughter children, but the Germans' obsessiveness and ferocity in exterminating Jewish children, conceived of as evil's biological seeds, distinguishes the German executioners from all others. In the camps called ghettos, they killed Jewish women who became pregnant. The biological thinking of German political leaders, the perpetrators, and many other Germans about the Jews' alleged perniciousness resembles the rest of humanity's, or at least the public health authorities' thinking about smallpox. To protect the world from smallpox's scourge, all smallpox, namely the virus every instance, needed to be eradicated. One festering smallpox case could infect others, resuming its plague on humanity. On January 1, 1967, the World Health Organization launched its intensified smallpox eradication program against a disease as old as known human history that still threatened 60% of the world's population, and that infected, at the time, 10 million to 15 million people annually, killing between 2 million and 4 million, and leaving most of the rest disfigured or blind. The program took almost exactly a decade to produce a smallpox-free world. The German political leaders and perpetrators considered the Jews such a powerful biological force, like smallpox, for evil, afflicting humanity almost from the beginning of recorded time, like smallpox, that they embarked on a comparable total eradication plan that, coincidentally, moved toward its final goal at a pace, had their conquests continued, similar to the World Health Organization's smallpox eradication campaign. Why would their plan differ given their beliefs, which Hitler summarized in the exterminatory campaign's midst? The discovery of the Jewish virus is one of the greatest revolutions that have taken place in the world. The battle in which we are engaged today is of the same sort as the battle waged during the last century by Louis Pasteur and Robert Koch. How many diseases have their origin in the Jewish virus? Japan would have been contaminated too if it had stayed open to the Jews. We shall regain our health only by eliminating the Jews. Everything has a cause. Nothing comes by chance. In working through the extermination program's codification, the Vannesi Conference participants discussed the need for every Jew's utter, total, and complete extermination in biological terms. The Germans believed the Jews surviving the brutal work-to-death regimen to which some would be put would be the most robust. They would therefore have to kill these especially dangerous foes outright. For if released, the Vannesi Protocol tells us, these Jews would, as a natural selection of the fittest, form a germ cell from which the Jewish race could regenerate itself. The Nazi leadership and Germans more generally had very different discourses about other groups the regime and its helpers set out to kill or eliminate. Slavic peoples, the mentally ill, Bolsheviks, gays, were the victims of prejudicial views rendering them lesser beings of one kind or another, but not the irredeemable powerful evil Germans broadly considered Jews to be, the ideological discovery of which Hitler and those sharing his views could speak in world historical terms as one of humankind's greatest revolutions. Also, these other groups' ideological construction, making it either necessary or permissible to kill them, had lesser degrees of acceptance in Germany. The country's political leaders did not undertake these other groups' total extermination, met far more resistance from Germans to their eliminationist programs against them, and pursued their ultimately partial, though still catastrophic, elimination with considerably less drive and determination. Analogously, country or culture-specific powerful eliminationist discourses grounded in models of the targeted group or groups as permissible or necessary to eliminate existed for the Germans in Southwest Africa, in Japan, for the British in Kenya, in Cambodia, in the Indian subcontinent, in Latin American countries, for other communist regimes, in the former Yugoslavia, for the Hutu, and for political Islamists, among many others. Radical intolerance is at the core of the eliminationist mindset. Even when a group, whether ethnic, religious, economic, or political, makes challenging demands on a country's political leaders or dominant group, a more inclusive view of society and the state rather than an eliminationist response can get adopted. Political leaders and the groups they represent can make political compromises and sacrifices, even material ones, to resolve real or imagined conflicts without expulsion or murderous violence. This has often been done, especially but not only in countries that became or are democratic. It needs to be emphasized that such deprecatory discourses about groups and peoples are not always explicitly eliminationist or murderous. More typically, they portray the people who will eventually be killed as worthless subhumans, evil, or a general threat, so that those participating in and exposed to such discourses become predisposed to accepting an eliminationist program or solution. The populaces may be aware of this disposition, as in Germany, in Burundi, among Serbs, and in Rwanda, or may not focus on policy options, particularly eliminationist ones, so they do not explicitly tell themselves or others that exterminating the hated or feared group is their goal. Either way, when their political leaders decide to opt for an eliminationist solution, those sharing the discourse's fundamentals and logical predispositions are ready for these beliefs to be activated into political action and to lend themselves in spirit or body to the eliminationist enterprise.